Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who is very familiar with the business of intelligence briefings, having given them, having received them in senior positions in the United States government, as well as a naval intelligence officer, is our first guest. His name is Robert Charles. He's held a number of important positions in addition to his time in the uniform of the United States Navy, as a counsel for congressional affairs in the White House under Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and then as an assistant secretary of state with responsibility for narcotics and law enforcement matters in the 43 administration, George W. Bush. He is an author of, among other things, Eagles and Evergreens, a prolific contributor to the public policy debate, I'm happy to say, notably on programs like this, but also as a spokesman for a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC. You can find him there at amac.us. Robert Charles, as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
A real privilege, Frank. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about growing concern I have, Bobby. Winston Churchill characterized it in his epic six-part history of the Second World War in the first book entitled The Gathering Storm. I'm fearful that we're witnessing a gathering storm that may break upon us in our time at any moment. And I wanted to just visit with you about three particularly problematic actors at the moment who seem to be prepared to act in concert, maybe a fourth as well, as it is very much a puppet, proxy, client, whatever you want to call North Korea, of communist China. But the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, under their respective dictatorships, all seem to be spoiling for a fight at the moment. And I fear that were they to have anyone go for it, all of them might, and possibly, as I say, precipitate a global conflagration. Is that an expectation that is realistic as you see it, or simply wild conjecture that is unlikely to eventuate?
You know, Frank, what a great question. And it actually is a question that has plagued different generations of Americans. Those particular actors in this particular time is what we have to confront. There is a balance that has to be kept between realism, preparation for what could happen, and complacency. And, you know, there's a great tendency, like inertia in physics, to believe that complacency is an okay policy, that somehow everything will just keep muddling through because we've muddled through to this point. And then there's the flip side of that, which is people who sort of see a crack of light in the curtain or darkness in the curtain and realize that there's something behind the curtain that could be very, very dangerous, and that we need to be prepared for that. You know, my own instinct is to, and people can overdraw the analogy to chess, but you know, we every administration, including the past one and this one, inherits a chessboard that already has pieces that have been moved around on it, and so you get the chessboard that you get. And now we see a very empowered China. We see a Putin and Russia that seems to think this might be their opportunity. We see an Iran that I think takes this administration for a collection of fools. And you see others around the world sort of reacting to those pieces on the chessboard and what they seem to be doing. You know, there's an old adage in playing chess, which I do. And, you know, you're not supposed to lean into a sacrifice play, because what can happen, so you can think, hey, if I take this, they'll take that, and everything will stop. The everything will stop thing doesn't happen. And very often what happens is you create a cascade of future moves that were avoidable that hurt everybody. And, you know, China can think this is their great opportunity to intimidate Taiwan into a policy change, or perhaps even take a military action against them, or perhaps contiguous islands. Russia can think this is their moment either to push into Ukraine, or perhaps to push through Belarus into pressure on Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, possibly even to put pressure from the north on Ukraine. All of these are bad choices, because at the end of the day, what will happen is that there will be necessary reactions. And what we have to be doing right now, and I said on Fox the other day, it was a little too little, a little too late. I don't know that it's ever too late, but it becomes harder and harder to deter bad acts the longer you wait to send your signal. And we need to be sending clear, credible, incontrovertible signals that say, do not cross this line, or these seven concrete consequences will follow, and they will follow within 24 hours. So let's be completely clear here. If you misstep, it will be a misstep that will create tremendous backwash that you don't want to have to encounter.
Bobby, let me just ask you, you talked about Iran discounting dramatically this administration, you said, as fools. I fear that the Russians and the Chinese have arrived at similar conclusions. It may be even worse in the case of the Chinese, I think, especially because I imagine they believe they actually own this administration, from the president on down through many of his subordinates. Long-standing ties to, some of them corrupt, some of them perhaps just ideologically aligned. In each case, it would seem as though that will greatly run counter to the idea you're talking about clarity and conviction with respect to deterrence. Do you fear, as I do, that especially in the absence of more robustness to this point, to say nothing of the Afghan debacle, that it's too late for deterrence?
You know, I think, Frank, that it's not too late. So credibility is everything. It's like in a courtroom. Credibility is everything. If you believe what you're being told and what you're being told is clear, you take it seriously. If not, you don't. And I'll tell you, if we turned on a light and just right now Ronald Reagan were the president, I'm going to guarantee you that China would back away. Russia would back away. Iran would back away. Ronald Reagan took out most of the Iranian Navy in the late 80s. They would say this guy's credibility is 110%. Right. Well, exactly. So point being, credibility is everything. And the problem this administration has is that there is doubt. It's for a lot of reasons. But the most recent one, which you just mentioned, is when you are willing to run away from a terrorist organization that, you know, asserts control in a, you know, seventh world country, and you are afraid of that, and it's crystal clear that you're afraid, and you've left more than 100,000 credentialed, American credentialed or connected or affiliated people in that country at risk, then if you're Xi or you're Putin, you say, holy mackerel, these guys, Biden is afraid to stand his ground against a two-bit, you know, country that is run by terrorists. Why would we think that he would be worried about us at all? In other words, you know, why should we hold back? And the problem becomes, whether you're pushing through Belarus into some sort of an affront on NATO countries, or you're pushing into Taiwan, the point is, where does a bad guy stop? Where does an adversary stop if there's no credible reason to stop? And that's my concern.
If they fear that it's game on. Figure that it's game on, that is. And that's my point, Bobby, going back to my opening question. To the extent that we're witnessing a gathering storm, for want of a better term, with these several actors seemingly telegraphing their intentions to act aggressively against neighbors, against longtime adversaries associated with us or actually allied with us. Do you anticipate that should one of them, perhaps by miscalculation, perhaps by accident, perhaps quite intentionally, does indeed take aggressive action, that the others will feel free, or freer, shall we say, to do the same in their respective areas of interest?
No question about that, Frank. If you see, you know, someone getting away with something and you're cut from the same cloth, unfortunately, bad guys tell us again and again that they'll follow the leader. I would tell you that we need to channel, even though these two personalities are very different, but we need to channel our best Senator Fulbright and say, you know, get Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate together with the Biden team and maybe a couple of former Trump people and say clearly together with one voice, don't you dare, because we may be divided domestically, but we are not divided when it comes to opposition to autocracy, totalitarianism, communism. We are not divided on that. And then the flip of that is sort of the harder message delivered by a Winston Churchill, who made clear that, you know, to paraphrase or to borrow from is one of his best lines, you know, appeasement is feeding the crocodile thinking that he's going to eat you last. We cannot engage in appeasement at a time and in an era in which the stakes are so high that there may not be a second chance once you lose the first chance.
I don't recall Senator Fulbright exhibiting those qualities. Are you thinking of Senator Vandenberg, perhaps?
Well, it could have been Vandenberg or it could have been Fulbright. The idea was that it stops at the border of our country.
At the water's edge, I think, was Vandenberg's favorite phrase. Bobby, is, and you're right, we do need to stand together, which brings me to my next and final topic with you. You wrote a very interesting piece for AMAC.us about what you call the Liberty Tribe. And it's so important to talk that through and hopefully affirm your calculations about what unites this country, which, especially if we're in the business of trying to deter something as portentous as a global conflict, we urgently need to demonstrate to friends and foe alike. Walk us through why you believe it's appropriate to say we are unified around liberty as a central premise and conviction of the American people at this point, given how many of them have been evidencing, of late at least, hostility to freedom.
Yep. So three very simple points. One is that George Washington in his farewell address actually warned us in language that is shockingly contemporary. He warned us of divisions from within, and he didn't use words like tribe or group identity or identity politics, but he warned us that factions internally will divide us and foreign nationals will want to divide us, and we must stay focused on what binds us, number one. Number two, this idea of tribes is a modern notion that the left has picked up and run with. It very much plays into the Marxist idea that somehow we should divide upon one another by race and by geography and by economic nation, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a false premise. We as Americans need to understand that what binds us, the reason that whatever you're looking at around you right now exists, the reason that freedom generated that extraordinary environment that you sit in, walk in, drive in, work in, is because we are actually bound much more tightly by the principles that are embodied in the Bill of Rights, in particular liberty at large, than we are bound by any subsidiary tribal connection. Even if, and so I like to say, Americans have more in common with every other American, believe it or not, than they do with anyone else in the world. And that really goes to the third and simplest point, and that is that liberty, in a way, we are the first population, the first people, the first sovereign people in the history of humanity to pull ourselves together and say we are bound by an idea, not by our language, although our language is English, but not by our hair color, not by our skin color, we are bound, not by our geography, we are bound by an idea. That idea is more powerful than any adversary's other strengths against us. And that idea is that we believe that individual liberty is paramount and that everyone of every color, shape, size, age, station deserves the respect that comes with our Bill of Rights and the idea that that we are a free people.
I know that's been the case historically, Bobby, and I pray that it will be the case going forward. I worry, though, I have to say, about both the combined effects of what foreign adversaries have been doing to sunder our bonds built on liberty. Personally, I think a part of that has been the use of the COVID-19 pandemic by Chinese Communist Party to divide us, to import the China model, as they call it here, the social credit system and so on, all of which is antithetical to liberty. And an awful lot of Americans have gone along with it. And then there's the problem, Bobby, as we've talked about frequently in the past, of, you know, how Americans have been educated to think about these things for a generation or two. And there again, you see fault lines, and those fault lines have been exploited by domestic enemies of freedom, I would argue, as well as foreign ones. So as one talks about this problem, and I, again, commend you for talking in ways that encourage our best selves to operate and to come together and to dissuade adversaries, foreign and domestic, from thinking that they can exploit our obvious differences or undermine us in other ways. We've got to be cognizant, don't we, of some of these fault lines and the extent to which they have become very much at odds with our historical traditions and practices.
Yes. So four very straightforward points. First, we need to understand history as not a series of pinpricks that cause us to regret some aspect of it, but rather the big picture, how America got to be America. And that really comes down to teaching and teaching well in, from the public schools on up. Point number two, we should be worried, Frank. You're worried, I'm worried. Anybody who cares about the future of the country with the knowledge of the past should be worried. And that should keep us on our toes and constantly engaged. The third thing is education at large. That is to say, you know, Ronald Reagan reminded us it's an intergenerational fault line more than anything else. You can't, you know, if you forget the past, it's not in our DNA to revere freedom. We have to teach why freedom should be revered. And you know, the last point is what I'll call the 11th PowerPoint, and that is, you know, unlike a lot of things in life, coming to the epiphany, understanding what is true can happen at the 11th hour. And we're kind of creeping up on the 11th hour. So we need to be saying to ourselves and to everyone else, this really matters. Okay, dig deep, understand what the truth is, stop indulging your favorite political pet project, and start understanding that the Liberty Tribe idea that we are one nation under God, indivisible, must be made a reality because the world is buffeting us like a like an ocean storm, and we need to hold the seawall.
Well said, as always, Bobby Charles. Thank you for your collective service to our country, in office in particular, but also that you're rendering these days as a spokesman for the Association of Mature American Citizens. Next up, Anne McLean is next. We're going to talk with her about the importance of understanding our history and revering it.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
The situation in Charlottesville and with our statues is very serious. So I am very concerned about it. When someone is calling to melt down a piece of fine art, we should all be concerned. And that is what's happening over, you know, at the base of Monticello, where Thomas Jefferson founded his university.
Talk a little bit about why people see this as a necessary correct.
Well, Frank, to tell you the truth, I don't quite understand it, because for many years we heard fear no art from the left. This is Marxism. This is a cultural Marxist revolution. And every statue, as I wrote in my dissertation, is a multivalent piece. And it is, it's almost like a teacher in a classroom has a an object that helps bring to the minds of the students a full version of a historical situation. And so to obliterate those, to take them away, it depletes everyone. And not to mention the fact that this is fine art. This is not, you know, a hubcap put on a bumper, you know, stuck in the middle of a, of an urban space. This artist, Henry Schrady, studied for years and years and years the shape of a horse. He studied animals. He did dissections. His father was Ulysses S. Grant's personal physician. And he was a northerner. And he did the he sculpted the U.S. Grant Monument that is in front of the Capitol in Washington.
That's magnificent.
You see all the time.
And what is the subject of the statue that is being melted down in Charlottesville?
Well, I'm not willing to put that in as a fait accompli. I hope, yes, in that tense. It's Robert E. Lee on his horse Traveler. It's you know.
And Robert E. Lee, of course, was the commanding general of the most successful army of the Confederacy during the war. Before that, of course, he was also a man who had very impressively contributed to the Union Army's successes, notably in the war with Mexico, as I recall. He was a figure who, despite having led the Confederate forces, was revered, I think, by many Americans, and lived a distinguished life after the Civil War ended, did he not?
Indeed. In many ways, he was, next to George Washington, one of the finest Americans we've ever seen. He was beloved North and South. People asked, insurance companies asked for his name to be put on companies in New York City after the war because of his integrity and his virtue. He went through West Point without a single demerit, when you could get a demerit for having a tarnished button. He, so he had
an exemplary
many
man.
Things about
so,
him.
Anne,
exemplary man.
Talk a little bit about who is behind this effort to destroy you called it multivalent, I think, contribution to our understanding of history. What do you mean by that? And why is, I guess, Black Lives Matter, the organization and its adherents, so insistent on not just removing this magnificent statue of Robert E. Lee from the campus of the University of Virginia, but literally destroying it so that it can never be viewed or an inspiration to anyone else?
Frank, it's such a base emotion that they have. I have a hard time really comprehending how the Jefferson School, which is an African Heritage Center in Charlottesville, Virginia, can think this would do anything good for Africans of any kind. I know many conservative Black people in Richmond that love this statue, several who would be willing to speak about it. This is beyond pigment, beyond melanin. This, I believe, is a movement to totally transform the United States of America.
And as you say, this is out of the playbook.
People that are actually behind it.
Yeah, this is right out of the playbook of the cultural revolutionaries of Mao's time and other communist movements, basically, that starts with, for Marx, I guess, destroying history, making there only a future under them rather than a past that people might remember and as I say, revere. And how does that play into this larger agenda of fundamentally transforming this country?
I guess in some childish adolescent fit they're having, they think that's going to make them better, more powerful or more revered. But what they don't understand, it's going to be such a blot on them and on our country. And I think that may be part of the strategy as well. It's evil, in my opinion. This is not, you wouldn't take Beethoven's fifth symphony or any other piece of fine art and obliterate it so it could never be seen again. If people go through museums and they say, boy, I wish, we had more of this piece, the head is missing or the arm or, it's just so wrongheaded. And my mother told me, two wrongs don't make a right.
But it bespeaks, and does it not, essentially a destructive aspect to this whole agenda? And you're seeing it in Richmond, of course, as well, an entire street of that city, a main prominent street of that city has been essentially desecrated by the removal of statue after statue after statue. I gather, though, they've been removed to some place where they can still be viewed in a museum or what have you. But still, this is about sort of the revolution, it seems to me, and your passion for your expertise concerning art and art history, is something that I so appreciate you sharing with our audience, because it's just a microcosm, really, of what these cultural revolutionaries, these Marxists, have in mind for all of us. And this brings me to your efforts on a classical education as well. Talk a little bit about how in this environment the problems that impacted so dramatically the election in Virginia in this last cycle in November are really evidence of the state of the indoctrination of our kids in our public school systems, and to the same end, the same destructive end as what's being done to these works of art?
Oh, thank you for that question, Frank. It's well stated. Yes, back in 2009, I saw such mission drift in the curriculum, even in our private schools, because the education graduate schools seem to believe or have, you know, changed their philosophy. And a lot is coming from Columbia. Marxism is being pushed out. Everyone who is listening right now, if you have a child in the public school, I would highly recommend fleeing that, spending time with your child. If you can't find a small, authentically Christian program, then I think your child would be that much better served being homeschooled. They're building an army of haters of America in through our public schools. Now, I know there are very many fine public school teachers that are caught or they have to pay their bills, but what is being forced in through the teachers' unions and through the curriculum is really anathema to our free republic. And it is very serious. And we've seen a lot in Loudoun County, in Virginia, but all over Virginia, Chesterfield, the school board someone is paying Marxists to run our schools and our school boards. I don't know who that is, but they have a harm, I believe. They wish to transform our nation, and our free republic will not last. You know, the founders understood we needed strong small schools, Christianity, morality. John Adams said, our nation is only fit for a moral and religious people. And through religious, he meant Christian. And Christianity is factual. If you study apologetics, you understand how things written down 800 years prior to their actual happening, you know, Isaiah predicted down to 10 to the 33rd power. Lots of events that no one could have staged. And so we seem to be getting less wise in our nation than when we started. Many more technological advances, golden age of medicine. We've done a lot, but we've somehow turned our back on truth, and that truth is discernible, and that an honor and honesty. And we need that. And our children need to know that in no uncertain terms. I'm a very traditional mother. We have four daughters, and you know, parents are not to be their children's best friends or to give them everything they want. You are to point them toward truth and honesty for them to thrive later and to be able
That's
to
such an important
up.
Point. McLean is our guest. You're talking about a phenomenon. You believe, and I think you're absolutely right, that it's not been an accident that we've seen this radical overhaul, basically, of curricula and pedagogic practices. And you know, in a way, thank God for the COVID-19 pandemic, to the extent that it brought to the attention of an awful lot of parents across this country exactly what was being, and is, for that matter, being taught to our kids, and how and by whom. And as you say, there are many fine teachers, and I'm sure they're as horrified by what they're being obliged to subject children to as we are. But it does raise this question, to what end? Is it the same end as this assault on our history, on our art, that conduces to, as I said, fundamentally transforming our nation?
I believe it is. I believe it's an attack on the family. See, Marxists have to eliminate three things. They have to eliminate Christianity, the family, and private property. And you see inroads being made in all of these, if you read the newspaper or are at all aware. I believe that children, this is a terrible time for children. Not only have they been masked up for now 2 years, if they're lucky enough to be born, then they go to, you know, a daycare center. And I know some people need to do that, and there are, you know, various degrees of time that a child could spend at a mother's morning out or something like that. But I believe the people that are pushing this really have, and Biden has said himself, they want to take that baby from the minute it's born all the way through high school and have the state be the parent, more or less. And
well, this is part of the
so
Build
wrong.
Back Better agenda, is it not?
But they have to tear down. That phrase just tells you everything. To build back, they want to tear down and destroy. And I believe we live in an extraordinary nation that was built by the sacrifice of soldiers that did not get to come home, and they left their families because they understood how important freedom is. And this is an assault on so many veterans that gave their lives. It's an assault on, well, decency itself. And everyone who is listening, I hope they can do what they can in their own communities. Stand up, be brave, talk, do what you can do.
To that point, and talk a little bit about what you and others did in Virginia in this election last November to do what you can do. How did you do it? How did others in, you know, school boards and in town councils and other places engage as precinct captains in, you know, the election process itself and the like, that can give us sort of a roadmap for how a difference can be effected nationwide, not just, you know, sort of in the abstract, but in very practical terms?
Well, this was a man of just about your age, I guess. He had just retired. Maybe he was a little bit older. He took his energies from his business career, and he and his daughter got busy. And he said, "This something is fishy. Something's wrong. They're stealing from us. They talk about democracy. Stealing votes is, you know, one way to destroy anything small d democratic." And so they.
Can you give us his name?
They organized. At this point, I know
he'd rather
I
remain
can't,
nameless.
You know,
okay. Behind the scenes.
Yeah, but
okay.
but he's fantastic, and they got together and they did Zoom calls, and the women got involved, and his daughter marshaled a lot of people. They had a big summit here in Richmond about election integrity. People came from all over the state, learned how to do it. We got eyes on the ballot. So we had people that would serve both as, someone who watched and then also as an election official. I did both. And we staffed it. So there was a stopgap. Originally, I thought that wasn't going to be enough, but it was enough. Thank the Lord that we were able to have that in all, you know, down in the city and all across the state.
You know, I thought it wasn't going to be enough either. And in particular, when they stopped the vote counting in Fairfax County, a heavily Democratic area that, you know, has had notorious problems in the past with voting fraud and manipulation and the like. And my sense of it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Ann, that the vote for Greg Youngkin and his team, Glenn Youngkin, excuse me, was so vast that it was too big to steal. It wasn't that they weren't prepared to try, but that the cumulative effect of the kind of efforts that you're talking about, the passion that was exhibited by voters who did not want more of the same and wanted very powerfully to send a signal, not just in Richmond, but I think to Washington as well, that this was time for a course correction, could not be overcome by the usual shenanigans that we've seen in the past in, well, Fairfax County, among other places in Virginia, and certainly in swing states in the previous presidential election. No,
that is the key. Local action. Everyone getting busy. That's what our nation was founded for. Small towns. I believe, you know, small towns, small churches, small schools, large families. That's what made us, as Alexis de Tocqueville noted, that's what made our nation special. And that provides freedom. And when you keep things local, you don't get these huge, massive problems like the globalists want. I can't believe after World War II, 80 years, it seems like there's huge cycles in 80-year time swaths. It was 80 years between the revolution, American Revolution, and the Civil War. And it's been, you know, about 80 years now. From World War II, you know, and so things just seem to go in those waves. And to survive this one, we are all going to have to remember our first principles. Remember what John Locke said, you know, and that the things the founders studied is why I'm interested in classical Christian education. They were brilliant men that understood the nature of God, the nature of man, and the nature of evil. And they designed this government to be able to, you know, like a building for, you know, that's well designed to survive an earthquake, it can adjust a bit, but not to be changed. There's a whole philosophy that change, change, change. And it's, I don't like to use the P word progressive. I think they're regressive. It's
I think they're communist and Marxist, actually.
They're communist.
Whatever you call it, this is such an important insight. And we're going to have to come back to you to develop it further if we can, Anne McLean. We're out of time for today, but this is so important to understand where we have come from, to prize it, the good, the bad, the ugly, as part of the history that made this country what it is, as you say, through cycle after cycle, through sacrifices of so many, in uniform and otherwise. And we ignore it, we fail to recall it, and certainly to embrace it at I think, the extreme peril of our country and of our children, who we want to have enjoy the freedoms that we have for so long and that, unfortunately, too many of us take for granted. Anne McLean, you do not. We thank you for your time with us today. I know you'll keep up the great work in Richmond and beyond, and hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the state of our world and more.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is always a delight to be able to say we have Zach Voorhees in the house, virtually, of course. Zach is a remarkable former top software engineer for a little company called Google and its YouTube subsidiary. He worked for them for about 8.5 years. He left, however, in June of 2019, importantly with a treasure trove of information from inside the company, inside the wire, as they say, about what Google was up to that really did require close scrutiny. He has worked manfully in the intervening period to bring Google's dirty little secrets, shall we say, to public attention and scrutiny and hopefully corrective action. He is the author most recently of Google Leaks, a book about, some of that data and his experiences as a whistleblower and within the Silicon Valley world. You can follow him on Twitter at perpetualmaniac and at zachvoorhees.com as well. Zach, it's been a while since we've talked. I'm sorry that we've not been more closely in contact, but I am really excited to have a chance to catch up with you. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's good to be on here. Thank you for plugging my Twitter. It cringes me a little bit whenever I hear perpetual maniac being thrown out there because it is my gamer tag and it got absorbed into my political social media account.
Well, I think if the shoe fits, wear it. At the very least, it's a catchy way to remind people that you are in the fight. Let's talk about the nature of that fight, if we can, Zach, because like I suspect a lot of our audience, I know a little bit about social media. I'm not as good at it as I'd like to be. I'm deeply appreciative for my friend and colleague keeping track of what we're supposed to be doing in that space. But specifically, I'm interested in what Google and companies like it in the big tech space have been doing to affect free and fair elections to this point, and to the extent that you've got insights into what they're up to now, what it's likely to mean for the prospect for, well, free and fair elections in the future.
As I've disclosed in the past, Google has a real-time monitoring system called Real-Time Events, which looks for signals out there on the internet, processes it through its Borg cluster on a software platform called HiveMind, and it looks for signals that it can use in order to figure out what the heck is going on and respond to it within minutes of, you know, it outbreaking. And right now what we have effectively is a software system called Machine Learning Fairness, which is Google's AI sort of censorship / governance algorithm. And what it does is it generates these classifiers that respond to events, and it's able to be trained on news stories and able to figure out whether something should be boosted, something should be suppressed, or whether something should make it to the top of the page. And this re-ranking algorithm is being used on events as they come out in a 24-hour news cycle. This was turned on especially for Donald Trump, where if you tried to find any sort of relevant information that was positive to him, then there would be a carefully worded article that would trigger on those keywords that you would use. For example, let me just say, like, Obama kids on cages. If you were trying to find specifically information on whether, you know, the whole kids in cages thing that happened, what was it, circa 2018, whether that was a change in policy or whether that was a new policy. And instead of giving you objective information, it would be rediverted towards articles that had just come out in the 24 hours where they would literally say Obama kids in cages, but then instead of expanding on a previous policy, what they would do is they would redirect it towards negative news for Trump. And it's this,
you know, I had an interesting experience, if I could just share this as well, in my own using experience or that of my family. My wife and I were going to go down to the mall, not the Capitol, the mall for the Trump rally on the 6th of January. And she shared this with a rather left-leaning, shall we say, daughter. And the daughter immediately, we could hear the clicking in the background, went for a Google search and came up with information that this was actually a poor boys rally and these, you know, violent extremist types were going to be down on the mall and tried to persuade us not to go. And my wife did a little bit of Google searching herself and found no, according to her search engine results. It was a Trump rally, which is, of course, what it actually was.
What search engine was your wife using?
I assume it was Google. I don't remember firsthand, and I haven't spoken with her about it since. But the point was she got a very different result from our daughter. And I guess that speaks to your point that these artificial intelligence and algorithmic techniques are being used to fashion what we take aboard from Google, and it can be quite manipulative, can it not?
It can. And what's interesting is that Google has become so extreme that anything centrist will seem like a polar opposite of a lot of the information that Google is pushing out there because of its machine learning fairness. You know, what's happening is that they're essentially creating two Americas, one that gets their information from, a different side, and the other one sees a completely different movie of what's taking place in America.
So it's really contributing to the polarization of our society. And is it to an end? Is it safe to say, based on your experience inside the belly of the beast, Zach Voorhees, that this has an ulterior motive on Google's part?
Well, what's interesting is that when Google was doing it, it was in the context of getting rid of Trump and sort of putting a lid back on populism. I mean, they pretty much said as much 1 week after the election in that very famous meeting that was leaked onto Breitbart, that they hoped that, and this was from Sergey Brin, said that he wanted to, you know, make this a blip on the history of the United States. And so, Google is, you know, what exactly is the end game of what Google is trying to do? And, you know, after everything that's happened with the vaccine and the COVID pandemic and all of the sort of totalitarian exercises that are going across the world, I have to wonder whether we're in some sort of global color revolution attempt or whether we're just, you know, being fed sort of like a bread and circus while major changes go on behind the scenes. I think that, I mean, and I can go deeper into this, but the fundamental thing that's happening is that people's labor and intellectual value is sharply decreasing in the age of artificial intelligence and robotic labor coming online more and more. And as this transition takes place, there is a question of what do we do with all the now useless human beings that are on the planet at around, you know, 8 billion large that aren't going to have anything to do. And right now, a lot of the things that are happening to us, in my opinion, are it's kind of a bread and circus show. And as this system gets closer and closer to being implemented, I'm talking about the social credit system, you know, universal basic income, these new world order plays, that the games at the Colosseum are going to get larger, never smaller. And this is kind of what we're seeing right now.
This is so interesting and really important. Zach, I think we need to have time for a much more in-depth conversation about it. But you've put your finger on a couple of things that maybe we could at least briefly develop at the moment. This idea that we are to be distracted from whatever's going on, whether it's a color revolution, whether it's a fundamental transformation, whether it's, you know, a Marxist takedown of our country, or a combination of all of the above, is of such great import that the fact that most of us are really oblivious to it suggests it's an extremely successful operation that's been mounted here. And it's not just by Google, let's face it. It's Facebook, it's Twitter, it's, you know, YouTube, it's these big tech giants writ large. And to the extent that we are diverting our gaze, if you will, from things that ought to be deeply problematic and responded to by us, lest we lose our country, for example, what's the corrective to that? Zach, I mean, you've obviously felt that one corrective was coming forward with information about what's going on. But beyond that, what should we be thinking about, and more to the point, doing to try to protect ourselves and our loved ones and our economy and our country from the cumulative effects of all of this?
Well, one of the big transformations is that our data is being harvested and sold to the highest bidder. You know, people are like, how do I protect my privacy? And I think that the name of the game of protecting your privacy is pretty much coming to an end. The big thing on a social scale is protecting our privacy from our data from being sold to our foreign adversaries. I've long suspected that one of the ways that Google's actually generating a lot of its revenue is through the selling of personal data to the Chinese Foreign Intelligence Office, also to the UK and other places which are friends, but also strategic rivals. And I think that what we need to do is, as a society, you know, start asking some questions of what are the deals that Google and Facebook and Twitter have with these other companies? And are they exporting our data and selling it to the highest bidder? Because look, Google's about the size of Amazon, and Amazon's had a fundamentally transformative effect on our economy. I rarely buy any electronics outside of Amazon at this point. And I'm pretty sure that most of your friends and family have experienced a similar shift. But I don't recall ever buying a product through a Google ad. No one that I know in my own family or friends has ever bought a Google ad or a product from a Google ad. And despite the fact that Amazon and Google are about the same size, roughly, I can look around and see that Amazon's had a fundamental change in the way that everyone interacts with the economy. But I don't really see Google having that same impact. And so the question that I have, I mean, it's not even close to the same impact. So the question I have is, what is Google's real business model? Are they engaged in surveillance capitalism? Are they taking our data in aggregate and selling it to the Chinese or to the UK or to, you know, our geopolitical rivals? And I think that the answer might be yes. And it's something that we need to look into, because there's an asymmetrical advantage that China has if they can purchase the real-time location data on every single one of the US citizens, and we can't do the same thing to theirs. That means that if we have an individual or a politician speaking out against the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, could they be targeted by the Chinese, you know, version of the CIA? And I think that the answer is yes. And what would be our retribution for that? And the answer is very little, because we don't have access to the real-time location data of the Chinese citizens. And so there's this asymmetrical advantage that our geopolitical rivals have. And I think that what Europe is doing with the data retention policies of users is something that's eventually going to have to come to the United States. It's not something that needs to be put on everyone. It needs to be put on these giant big tech monopolies that reign over much of social media.
And just explain that, if you would, the data retention project that the Europeans are involved in. That means essentially retaining your privacy of information?
Yeah, and what you can do with it and how you can transfer it and where you can locate it. You know, one of the things that Facebook likes to do is
And when you
like
say you mean the tech giants users. Users themselves and their data.
So the tech giants like to take user data in aggregate and host it in servers located in countries that are friendly towards, you know, essentially anarcho-capitalism, right? Like, let's say Iceland is a great place for a lot of this stuff. You put in there, they've got different jurisdictions. So this Iceland policies exist instead of the regular laws. That works great for a lot of free speech stuff. But for housing, like warehousing all of like Facebook's data, that's an existential threat. You know, if you're a French citizen and you do a social media post criticizing the government, that information needs to be kept inside of France. You don't want it being hosted in China or Iceland. And that's sort of the direction that Europe is going. They're saying we need to host this data here and be able to do what we want with it. And that needs to happen with the United States as well. If you make a post or check into a site, that data needs to stay in America. It doesn't need to be warehoused anywhere else. And this needs to apply to the big tech monopolies. The scary thing about regulation is that it can be utilized as a weapon for the small time people where, you know, if I throw up a website, that's small for my friends, I don't want to come under the hammer, an international, you know, data retention regime that, you know, forces me to comply with all this stuff or face stiff fines. And that's always the problem is you want to hammer the big guys so that they don't present a security threat to your nation without letting the individual let them continue to operate and innovate.
We have to leave it at that, I think, Zach, for the moment. But there's so much more that I want to bore with you if I can, particularly on this issue of the national security implications of this hoovering up of our private data, its susceptibility to being manipulated, exploited at a minimum, quite possibly abused by these tech giants or hostile governments like the Chinese Communist Party. Zach, thank you for these insights, really, and for the work that they reflect based on both your time at Google and YouTube and the time that you have spent since trying to explain all this to us and as I say, get corrective action taken. And again, thank you for the newest book, Google Leaks. I commend it to all of our listeners and hope that they will be following you closely at the title again. Sorry, Perpetual Maniac.
Yeah, it's at twitter.com/perpetualmaniac where I drop intel. My book, Google Leaks, could be found at googleleaksbook.com. Very well rated, very well received. It goes into the backstory of how the leaks came about and sort of the details of what Google was doing on the inside that you can't always get on, a news blast. And if your users want to find or your listeners want to find the information that I disclosed, they can go to zachvoorhees.com.
There we go. Thank you, Zach. Come back to us again soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afte. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.